The last two papers of this morning's session have been paired up for a reason. They're theoretical, they're explorative, non-traditional maybe, could be another word. And the first presenter is Jonathan Allen. And I have to say, I can't really say welcome to Jonathan, but rather welcome back, Jonathan. He is a graduate of our first year of students in our SCLAW program back in, I don't want to date myself, but he was my first MA student I supervised. So he has completed his PhD in comparative literature at the University of Toronto, fully Shirk-funded, which is an achievement in itself. He is now, his dissertation at U of T was The First Time and the Morning After on Love, Loss, and Virginity, in which he explored anecdote, critical theory, and psychotherapy. And today he's going to talk to us about affecting testimony, experiments in prose in pedagogy. So welcome back, Jonathan.
That's yours. So affecting testimony, experiments in pedagogy and prose. In her experimental memoir, A Dialogue on Love, the late, the much-loved, and the still-mourned, Eve Kosofsky-Sedgwick asks her therapist, Shannon, what kind of narrative are we trying to construct, or do we think we need to construct about Eve's history? I mean, what's the purpose of it? What do we want from it? End quote. As I struggled to write this paper, and there were at least seven drafts, I returned often to Eve Sedgwick, and in many ways I thought about the importance of Sedgwick to how I approach the study of literature, how I think and how I want to think about affect, and how I imagine the pedagogical space, and my all too tentative and incomplete thoughts about testimony. But her question in therapy, a private space of incredible testimony in which we work through so much, strikes me as a worthy starting point for how we approach testimony today and how we envision the project that is unfolding here. What kind of narrative are we trying to construct? Or do we think we need to construct? So I'm just going to have slides of some of the writings that I'm talking about. You don't need to stress out too much, but in this one here you can see in the sort of standard prose, we have Eve writing, and then we have these sort of poems, Haibun, which is Eve again, and then where we see the standard block letters. These are Eve's therapist's notes from her therapy sessions. So we have the whole thing sort of coming together here. So Sedgwick's A Dialogue on Love, Michael Moon tells us, explores in collaboration with a sympathetic psychotherapist the roots of relation between her post-cancer diagnosis depression and her earlier struggles with sometimes powerful depressive tendencies, end quote. By any number of estimations, Sedgwick's memoir, a memoir about breast cancer and depression, living through the time of AIDS, watching so many of her friends die, functions like a testimony. We are provided with a genre-defying memoir that braids together prose, haibun, haiku sort of poetry, the notes of her therapist, and her own sort of immediate reflections, both in therapy and after therapy. This text, perhaps more than any other, bridged pedagogy and practice. Catherine Kent recalls that in Sedgwick's course, Experimental Critical Writing, she asked us to mix genres, to make from a variety of discourses a kind of palimpsest that might bring together our own erotic attachments, whether they be formal, thematic, perverse, banal, those for which we had often been shamed. I admit here that it might feel as if we've managed to go off course already, but it seems to me that the demands of orientation, the limits of genre, the coherence of discipline might well be what hold us back when we confront a subject matter like testimony, which defies the normal. As John Beverly notes, the testimonial is a unit of narrative that is usually the life of a significant experience, for example, the experience of being a prisoner. The testimonial is not normal. It is significant. It is filled with meaning. The testimonial tells readers and listeners of extraordinary experiences. And then, for some reason, in the space of the academy, we wish to treat it formally, generically, clinically, historically, and so on. I want to embrace a less coherent mode of responding to testimony, admitting that these texts are powerful precisely because they defy the limits, they test what we believe, and perhaps above all, they challenge what and how we read. I want for us as scholars of testimony to admit our formal, our thematic, our perverse perhaps, our banal attachments when we write about testimony, when we read testimony, and when we imagine a scholarship that engages in experimental, critical writing. In so doing, I would like to see a testimonial scholarship that avoids critiques of form and genre. Insofar as I'm not interested in whether or not this is quote-unquote literature or a novel, as is one of the sort of standard questions, can we speak of the testimonial novel? And in so doing, we offer, or at least I offer as a new question to think about, what is the affective potential of testimony, and what does that mean for scholarship? My answer to this question would revolve around the moving, the touching, the feeling potential of testimony in its many forms and its many genres. We admit that texts are touching. We do it in all kinds of spaces, book clubs, poetry readings, and perhaps, but unfortunately not nearly often enough, the classroom. To admit the touching, feeling quality of prose, of poetry, is to go against the grain of so many schools of thoughts and literary studies. I want to be careful here, for I'm not imagining that we will all sit around talking about our feelings. Rather, I am suggesting that we will consider what those feelings might mean. Thus, we are not falling to what Wimsatt and Beardsley once quaintly called the affective fallacy. Instead, behind the language on the page, we might admit that there is something raw. If we believe, as Wayne Kostenbohm imagines, that writing, alas, is never nude, grammar clothes me with adjectives, prepositional phrases, dependent clauses, a costume I did not choose, a costume that clashes with my native inclinations, we might then imagine that the nudity of prose is not found in its words, its styles, and its melodies, but in its feelings that are deeply couched in language. The inexpressible feelings, the guttural utterances that so often overwhelm us as we read, the moment we sit stunned, stupefied, silent, without language. Those silent pauses that lurk in a classroom that haunts every professor, I want us to let those hang there a bit longer. Or those moments in therapy when nobody has anything to say, a great deal is actually happening. And that pause that we desperately want to fill with noise, just so we don't have to listen to the silence any longer. I want to focus on these moments and to reframe our questions and our ideas about testimony. The affective, the cluttered, the confusing, the embarrassing moments in which we are discomforted. When things feel too much. I sort of note the French de trop here, which we often use as a way of not saying it's too much, so we turn to another language to do it. When we are without words, or when we would prefer to ask different questions, questions from another angle, we might borrow, and this is a strange line to read now too, we might borrow the question of, and indeed I can hardly utter these words, the late and the certainly gone too soon, José Muñoz, who wrote, "This leaves us to amend Gayatri Trakoborty Spivak's famous question, can the subaltern talk, can the subaltern speak, to ask, how does the subaltern feel?" That's a different question. We might think about that. Too often in the academy, far too often, we privilege a rigid thought process that relies on notions of logic, coherence, and figuring out what is missing, or finding a mistake that has yet to be corrected, or even we might go so far as to speak of a text failing. I would largely agree with our keynote that, quote, a truthful way of giving testimony should allow for disruptive memories, discontinuities, blanks, silences, and ambiguities. It should become literary, end quote. But I want to see our scholarly work, that is, the action of a scholar responding to testimony, begin to do the same thing, or at least something similar. As much as we might dislike, as much as we might be discomforted by the question of a stereotypical poetry professor, how does the poem make you feel? Everybody sort of gets queasy. I think there is much to learn from this prompt, as there is of Muñoz's question. But to know how we think things feel, we need a vocabulary that's going to enable us and affirm us these feelings, these affective responses. While I imagine my role today here to be one of negotiating affect and testimony, that's what I was asked to do, I would like for us to allow ourselves to dwell on how affect influences our own responses to the wonderfully eloquent phrase, touching feeling, those touchy-feely qualities of textual experience. Sedgwick notes that the touching feeling as a phrase contains a double meaning, tactile plus emotional, which is already there in the single word touching, and equally it is internal to the word feeling. Moreover, Sedgwick explains that she is also encouraged in this association by the dubious epithet touchy-feely, with its implications that even to talk about affect virtually amounts to cuteness contact. I know that we are quick to dismiss the touchy-feely as less than academic. Indeed, colleagues in other units of the university might refer to the humanities, and most certainly literary studies, as a touchy-feely discipline, in a pejorative and kind of dismissive way. However, this affords those of us who are touchy-feely an opportunity to think carefully about what the touching feeling might look like, and also perhaps and hopefully the possibility of teaching feeling. To deny touching feeling aspects of literary studies, cultural studies, gender studies, social justice studies, is to deny the numerous ways that we might engage with texts, or of what Sarah Ahmed has called the emotionality of texts, which is to say is one way of describing how texts become, to us as readers, moving. I am reminded here of an anecdote from Eve Sedgwick, and she writes, "When I teach a year-long Proust seminar, I have to start out trying to open my students to a wide range of their likely feelings about the narrator, and indeed the author. Condescension, dependence, disgust, fury, indulgence, for instance, along with the more anxious and ethical forms of respect that seem proper to the graduate student status. While Marcel Proust, I agree, is perhaps an all too obvious example of a text that is utterly overwhelmed with affective potential, we must nevertheless admit that we have affective and emotional responses and influences to these texts. These influences are all the more potent in texts that account for experiences that seem quite simply beyond the realm of the quotidian, or at least how I see my quotidian life. Texts move us, and that moving quality might well be the thing that stumps us, that bores us, that renders a text difficult," that wonderful word that we hear when we ask our students, how did the text feel? It felt difficult. A word that speaks as often to the intellectual difficulty of a text as to, I believe, the emotional and affective difficulty of a text. Proust's In Search of Lost Time is a difficult text, not least because of its layers upon layers of text and its 1.5 million words, but also because of its significant affective potential. We are too quick to dismiss the emotional and affective realms of the realms and potentials in literary studies, because we imagine that we cannot defend these aspects. Indeed, I can think of no other way to articulate this dismissal of affect than to return to poetry. But when the crucial moment comes, our boldness and our daring disappear. Our spirit is shattered, comes unstrung, and we scramble all around the walls, seeking in our flight to save ourselves, and yet our fall is certain. So writes the Greek poet C.P. Kavafi. Emotions and affect become the great crisis from which we have been trained to scramble, and yet, and I take so much pleasure in reading this, our fall is certain. In another translation, it reads, we're sure to fail. Nothing can be more successful than our failure to account for and admit the affective potential of text, the nudity of prose, the truths of one's emotions that cannot be accounted for within the confines and limits of language. Paulo Freire's response to the poem might share something in common with his second letter in Teachers as Cultural Workers. Don't let the fear of what is difficult paralyze you. The limits of language, limits that cannot and will not contain us, are precisely what we should be interested in when we respond to testimonial narratives and our reactions to them. We must remember that the affects can be and are attached to things, peoples, ideas, sensations, relations, activities, ambitions, institutions, and any number of other things, including other affects. Thus, one can be excited by anger, disgusted by shame, or surprised by joy, as Eve Sedgwick writes. We must recognize the slipperiness of affective responses to the emotionality of text. I refuse to believe that there is a, quote, correct or singular affect when reading. And instead, I would urge us to think about the complexity and multiplicity, the intersections and networks, and we can choose any numbers of words to describe these affects as assemblages, rhizomatic, genealogical, arborescent, you choose it, you can do what you want with it. But we must allow for and permit excited humiliation, disgusted shame, the complexities of our emotions. For the duplicitous, the ambiguous, and indeed what I believe the liberating, touching feeling. And for the curiously problematic idea of research interests that enable us to study something like testimony, as if indeed it's actually a sort of interest. I take interest in this thing and I enjoy this thing. And to recognize the complexity of that. And to bridge, I hope, pedagogy with activism. We need to think that the slipperiness of these touching feelings when we read these narratives, we need to know that they are there and we need to recognize them as part of the process, both for ourselves and in our classrooms. Encouraging us to think about affecting testimony will enable us to recognize the pedagogical and political potentials of teaching feeling and teaching testimony. Opening ourselves to this kind of reading admits the, quote, uncontrollable meaningfulness of the body, end quote, from Eve Sedgwick again, which is, I would argue, central to any call for embodiment as a thematic theme that centers this conference. I want to position experimental and critical writing as central to the development of testimonial scholarship, especially when we frame it as a pedagogical and research question. To these ends, as we think about where we go from here, I would encourage us to mull over different ways of writing and speaking these truths. The truths in scare quotes. These papers, these feelings. How do these testimonies feel as we read them? What feelings do we imagine are contained in the words? How are we supposed to feel? How does the text feel to us? In responding to these questions and allied questions, I would argue we must look elsewhere for ways of answering these questions. What would it mean, for example, to think about collaborative modes of writing when engaging with testimony? Too often the work of the scholar is solitary. Even beyond collaborative writing, what would it mean to deploy and draw on the pedagogical teachings of Paulo Freire and the performative writings of Augusto Boal? Boal's Poetics of the Oppressed, which I learned about here at Brock, no less, for instance, focuses on the action itself. The spectator delegates no power to the character or the actor, Boal writes, either to act or to think in his place. On the contrary, he assumes the protagonic role, changes the dramatic action, tries out solutions, and I think that's a key point here, tries out solutions, discusses plans for change, in short, trains himself, herself, for real action. Accordingly, we are able to admit that the theater is not revolutionary in itself, but it is surely a rehearsal for the revolution. The liberated spectator as a whole person launches into action. I admit that I can claim no expertise to these modes of pedagogy and performance. At best, I flirt with them. But what I am certain of is that they are marked, touched, and tickled by the affective lives of those involved. If we opened our classrooms to innovative modes of thinking that abandoned the structures and strictures of academic, institutional, and scholarly demands for normalcy, I say this as somebody who's currently teaching university writing, we might well open new modes of thinking about complex texts like testimonials. We might very well end up imagining and performing any number of solutions, plans for change. We might well be training ourselves and our colleagues and our students for real action, an action that recognizes and embraces the totality of the emotionality of these texts. To close then, and to close prematurely, The testimonial narrative challenges us not only to recognize the abuses of the human spirit, but also, and more importantly, how we might reframe the pedagogical space. And in many ways, I want this space in my dream world to become performative, experimental, affective. This space must be democratized so that we can admit that we fail. We must admit that we fail. And in that failure, we find, encounter, and imagine new solutions, new possibilities for understanding. Nothing is too big to fail, in a sense. I want us to accept that failure brings about a sort of re-approach to these texts. These texts, testimonial texts, I am absolutely certain seem like sites of failure, not for the text, not for the author, but for the reader. The moment when we simply cannot understand, or we simply do not want to understand. Or we simply just put the text down. It is too much to even fathom. It seems that these moments reveal to us our inability to be moved enough, and thus I imagine that this becomes the moment in which we desperately, desperately need to relieve ourselves of the rigid compulsions of disciplinary coherence. We must actively bring together pedagogy, performativity, affect, experimental critical writing so that we can figure out how to reveal the nudity of prose. And in so closing, I return to my opening question, Eve's question, and readdress it to all of us here. What kind of narrative are we trying to construct? Or do we think we need to construct? I mean, what's the purpose of it? What do we want from it? Thank you.